today.
Cool.
We have called to order the House Committee on Healthcare for March 23rd, 2015, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3352. Call Representative Evans to the stand. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, Independence, Monmouth, West Salem, South Salem, the prettiest river district in the state, at least I like to try to say.
Being from Clackamas and living on the Well, excuse me.
Well, okay, maybe the second or third prettiest then.
There we go. Maybe fourth, and we pass the bill, Mr. Chair. Can we make a deal?
Hey, you know, we will do that. House Bill 3352 started out as a relatively simple idea that was focused on some things that the state of Washington is doing. It's offered at the request of Mr. Marvin Sands, who's going to come up with our panel in a few minutes. The bill was focused on trying to emphasize something that has been passed, actually, one of the chambers in the past year, having to do with addiction disorder as an illness. But as you can read the bill, it's a little more expansive than that, focusing on prioritizing services that are more wraparound in nature for critical addiction treatment. So I'm going to hand the ball off, if that's all right, to the folks that can talk about this program and idea in detail. And I just want to thank the committee for giving this bill the time, because it is, I think, one of those important aspects that we don't always spend a whole lot of time talking about. So thank you for the opportunity. If there's thank any you. Questions, I'll back away and let them come up.
Madam Minister, will you call a panel?
Sure. Marvin Sands, Jim Conway, Bill Dalton.
In any order, but please introduce yourself when you start your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Marvin Sanis. I live at 640 15th Street, Northeast here in Salem. I'm here to support this. 2 years ago, we were here, and this committee voted on a resolution to recognize addictive disorder as illness. It passed the House of Representatives, I think, by over 80%, didn't it, Brian? Mm-hmm. And it went to the Senate, and the Republican caucus stopped it in the Senate, primarily because they could. We have an epidemic in this state. In 2001, a gram of heroin at North Salem High School cost $400. This morning at North Salem High School, you can buy a gram of heroin for $100. In our corrections system, over 70% of the people in the system are recognized with addictive disorder. I think the number is 77%. We offer treatment in 6 of 14 institutions. There is an immediate return if we recognize this disorder in the correction system and in the junior high schools. That's when most people start their disorder. 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. The issue cannot be addressed in the school system. It's just too hot. It's like sex education in junior high school. They just won't touch it. We tried to do an education program in the junior high schools in 24J, an elective that a seventh grader and eighth grader could take a class on alcohol and drug addiction. Can't touch it. They will not. The vice principals won't touch it. The school district won't touch it. So what this issue needs is leadership. You people, legislators, it's a political hot button. Somebody's going to call you soft on crime. Somebody's going to call you soft on these drug addicts, alcoholics. But this must be recognized as illness. And if we do that, there's a financial return immediately. Immediately, if we begin to treat this problem. For those of us who have children, grandchildren, this is life or death. It's a fatal affliction. So anyway, I'm here with a little emotion. This is so frustrating. so frustrating. We need some courageous politicians to take a lead and get this thing off the dime. We should be offering treatment in the corrections division. We should be offering information for these young children. So thank you very much for hearing this.
Thank you. Yes, let's hold the questions to the whole panel. Next.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Greenlick and the committee. My name is Jim Conway, and I'm a licensed psychotherapist in Oregon. I've been in the alcohol, drug, chemical dependency, treatment, and education field for over 40 years. When I look at this bill, it's a wonderful, concise, and straightforward bill. It asks the authority to prioritize and contract to allow early access and comprehensive and coordinated access to all the levels of treatment for Oregonians who can't pay for it. This bill, all the bills, I've been, like I say, in this field for a long, long time and reviewed a lot of cost-benefit studies. There's not a single cost-benefit study that says getting people into treatment and having the state come in to help with that that's a bad idea. It's a good idea in the short run, in the medium term, and in the long term, because it saves. Untreated addicts and alcoholics are costing us anyway. They cost us in very expensive incarceration enforcement, very expensive in terms of coming in and out of the medical system, what we call frequent flyers, for treating the symptoms of the disease and not addressing the underlying illness, the addiction. So when we address the underlying addiction, you find over the long term people use their health care consumption rates drop down. They're less expensive as patients within the system. They're less of a burden to society through incarceration, criminal activity, and recovering people return as productive people, taxpayers, their families rehabilitate. I'm a family therapist. I've run family treatment programs. Treating an addict and treating the family changes a multi-generational pattern that benefits society as a whole. So I appreciate you're allowing me to testify today and share this with you. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Dr. William Dalton. I'm a resident, I think you want the officials, of 6619 Huntington Circle, Southeast, here in Salem. And it's a pleasure to testify to this committee because it's got a number of folks on here who I know are very familiar with medical and social service issues. I think Mr. Sanis and Jim Conway have done a good job in hitting some of the highlights. If I was a politician and I was in Washington, D.C., and I wanted to put a title on this, it would probably be the tax reduction bill of 2015 to serve those with alcohol and drug addictions, because I think both of the previous folks who have testified have hit on a problem that I know you all are aware of, irrespective of what party you are a member of and where you are in the system. We have a revolving door syndrome with folks with addictions that is costing our state and our nation an incredible amount of money. And I grew up sort of on the forefront of creative preventive model mental health programs, which we had an opportunity first to implement in Josephine County. And I have seen firsthand the kind of success you can have in a small underfunded county if you try to address the issues early on in their etiology. Now here, and I think Mr. Sanis has focused well on some of the problems we run into in terms of education and prevention. I think this bill will help in those matters, but the thing that most excites me is that even until we're more effective in our efforts to do the kind of early intervention that will truly reduce the number of people that are ending up abusing alcohol and drugs, this bill points to a system and an approach that will enable us to reduce the costs of dealing with those people who are victims of alcohol and drugs, and those of us as taxpayers who have to work so hard to try and address the problems that they have and the problems that they create in our society. I'm familiar with a concept that many of you have probably heard about over the years called wraparound services. What most excites me about this bill is it takes a look at the spectrum of intervention that we need to do in order to be effective. We can't just keep putting people on our correction system and turning them out and expect that they're going to be fully functioning taxpaying citizens. We can't keep taking them into our emergency rooms and turning them out at 2 o'clock in the morning with no housing, no supports, no case management, and somehow expect that they're not going to show up again. This bill is exciting because it takes a look at housing, it takes a look at treatment, both outpatient and inpatient. And if you are an addicted person, inpatient treatment is often the entree to truly being cured. And I can say that based on my own family experience. I like the leverage that they have built into this bill in order to encourage people to get that kind of treatment. I think the fact that they're looking at job employment and housing supports makes this probably the opportunity to create a model program. Whether we have the money to do it statewide or whether we have the money to try it out simply in a few counties. I know Josephine County, where I worked, every time they wanted a rural, what they called beta site, a place to try something out, we always raised our hands, and we just had some incredible successes with programs that now have been funded statewide because they have been found to reduce costs. So I'm very, very appreciative of the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. Very appreciative of your attention in taking a look at this. Thanks much.
Let me start. I have a couple of questions for the panel. I spent the last 20 years of my research career studying substance abuse.
Right.
I think it's pretty well accepted now that addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disorder, and I think in the field that's pretty well accepted. And I did the Institute of Medicine book on bringing research and community treatment together. But we've been putting money, substance abuse, mental health treatment into Medicaid managed care and now into CCOs. And I wonder if you have a sense of what's not being covered in a CCO now, at least one that's doing it right compared to what's being in here. I mean, is it only wraparound services we're talking about, or is there some broader context of what's being missed by the CCOs in their current form?
I would be glad to comment on that. I think the CCOs is probably one of the absolutely best steps I've ever seen us take here in the state of Oregon in terms of addressing the breadth of issues that I've dealt with during my professional life. I think this bill would actually not substitute for that, but actually give further stimulus to the very kinds of things we're trying to accomplish with the CCOs, particularly in terms of trying to bring not just wraparound, but a single center of focus where you've got your treatment specialists, your professionals, your access to consultants, all taking place in a gateway kind of opportunity, which I, of course, think of as the primary
care. It's a delivery model, not necessarily a financing model.
I think it can have impacts on both, but yes, I think it's a delivery model that we're talking about here.
Okay, are there other questions for the panel?
I'd like to mention one success that's occurring in Salem, these Oxford homes. They're financed by the people who are in recovery, and they reinforce one another in a living situation. Yeah. They pay for the houses. I think we have almost 30 in Salem now. And it is an excellent, excellent model that we should be doing with our corrections population that you people have a responsibility for. The treatment for addictive disorder is abstinence. When we have somebody incarcerated for years, we have a tremendous opportunity to treat. He can be held accountable for abstinence.
I'm not sure it's that simple. Abstinence is certainly a part of it, but it's not the treatment.
Well, the American Medical Association in 1954 said the primary treatment for alcoholism is to not take a drink.
That's 70 years ago. We may have advanced a little since.
The science has advanced a little, but we haven't. move much.
President Bueller?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'm a little puzzled, to speak to Chair Greenlick's point, that there's no coordination with mental illness treatment with regards to this House bill. It seems like these two issues are being treated separately when they're very commonly, intimately involved.
The state of Washington found that it's an untoward thing to do to an alcoholic or an addict to be placed in the mental health. They don't seek treatment if it's mental. If it's an illness, they'll seek the treatment. But if they say, well, I have to go for mental health services, nobody likes to be put in that class. And it's really not a mental disorder. Addictive disorder is a brain disorder. It's not mental illness. It's a chemical. It's a chemical imbalance that's created in the brain from the use of the substance. Not a mental health issue. I mean, it becomes that way after prolonged use.
I think frequently they're linked, maybe in more subtle ways than what you think I'm referring to, but the second question, is there been a...
Before you go to the second question, can I comment on that? Because my own career has combined the treatment of mental illness and the treatment of AND and the community level. Our county mental health programs have responsibility for all of those. And I think at times we find folks who are carrying one banner or the other. I was the head of NAMI Oregon for several years. And I think there has been a tendency over the years to carry two banners. You know, I'm really in favor of dealing with alcohol and drug, and I'm in favor of dealing with mental illness. And I think you're hitting on a terribly important issue. Not only do we find that over 70% of the people in our correction system have addiction problems, we find that over 70% of the people with diagnosed mental illness have addiction problems. And also vice versa, 40-70% of those identified as having alcohol and drug problems are also identified with co-occurring mental illness. I don't support this because it takes a look at one versus the other. I support the bill because I think it's an opportunity to bring to that broad arena the fact that we have got to look at a spectrum of treatment involving housing support services, case management support services, employment services, and I would be saying exactly the same thing if this bill was addressing mental and emotional illness. We have made some progress, I think, with mental and emotional illness, just like we have with developmental disabilities. I think alcohol and drug has lagged behind. Sadly, I think part of the lag has been because we often get in this tug of war over is this a mental illness or is this alcohol and drug. I experienced that for several decades when I worked in the mental health system here in Oregon. I think the more we look at this...
We had them separated in the Medicaid program until recently, and now we have them together.
Yes. And if you wait long enough, they'll probably be separate again.
I hope not.
I hope not also.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for giving me a chance to jump in on that.
I see there's no fiscal impact yet, but it would have to be considerable, I think it's fair to say. Has there been any consideration of doing a pilot project to see how this would work before we jump all in?
I would just love to see that approach in the corrections system, a pilot project to encourage someone who's a nonviolent offender. We could put them out, insist on abstinence, have them take a urine test three times a week, have them take a blood test, have them pay for it. And the condition of their release is abstinence, which is the primary treatment for the substance abuse. Now, that's a very, very dangerous thing for you people to advocate.
We are doing exactly that in the correction system right now. And the correction system is moving exactly that way. Not treating abstinence as the treatment, but treating abstinence as a symbol, or the lack of abstinence as a symptom. But we are moving that way. The issue is outside of the
correction.
The correction system.
Yeah, if may I, Representative Bueller, think, you know, you can go in two channels, either a full state approach, I would favor that, or a pilot project with a rural county and an urban county to see. You'll find, I think either route will give you the same results. I think in a three-year study, if this is well done, the benefits will be obvious. they have been in other urban and rural states. Nobody has, who's gone into this, has said, gee, that was a bad idea. Wish we hadn't have done that.
I wish we could figure out how to stay funded, is what they're saying.
Well, you know, that's a tough argument, because the fiscal benefit comes later. It comes in cost savings. It comes in, you know, nobody's got a bag of gold right now to say, here, we got that covered. I wish we did. It takes that front-end commitment to get the long-term results. However, Oregon is already paying quite a bit for not doing this. It's paying, you know, hospitalizations for complications versus the disease, incarcerations. That's all expensive stuff, and that comes from the resources of the state. So if you redirect those resources in a way that reduce that, I think it's better.
It's hard to redirect future resources. It's hard to redirect the saving that's coming 10 years from now. We don't have that kind of ability to reach into the future.
Mr. Chairman, we have the corrections budget this you guys are going to be talking about is $1.6 billion.
And by doing things like this that we've been doing in the correction budget, we've reached a point where we have fewer inmates than we had 2 years ago because we're doing these kind of things. The problem is getting it outside of corrections, where we're having trouble finding resources. There isn't a professional in the state who doesn't believe wraparound services make a difference. The problem is, how do we figure out how to pay for it?
Yeah. I would like.
Senator Hayden?
Chair Greenlee, I've read through the bill and agree that would like to see more activity here. But my question on the bill is, if we're going to get further into this, where are our preventative services more at the school level to try and catch this before it becomes a problem, you know, more from a prevention angle rather than a reactive treatment? How would you suggest that we might try and tie that into a population that is at risk for this behavior but hasn't yet fallen into it?
Well, I think every junior high school in Oregon should have a class on addiction, alcohol and addiction studies, an elective class. These kids are interested in it. They have the problem at home. They have the problem with their friends. They're interested in it. But the school districts can't. It's a political hot. It's like teaching sex education in the seventh grade. The school districts won't touch it. They need leadership from our legislature to address this issue in the junior high schools.
Okay.
If I could comment, Rep. Hayden, I'm involved with the Safe Neighborhoods Project in the Portland area, where we are putting together really school-based preventive efforts. I think if you do good prevention, you also identify issues earlier. The sooner you bring people into treatment, the less expensive it is. If I can get somebody launched in recovery from an outpatient standpoint, that's less expensive than a residential program. And the sooner the educational effort. I mean, Oregon is going to change with Measure 91 implementation. It already has. I mean, I'm a geezer dad. I got a 15-year-old daughter who knows a lot more about drugs from seeing it around her school. And we live in Lake Oswego. It's not like there's socioeconomic differences. All the schools have this, and they're going to have this. And the more effort we put into that end, too, is, I think, essential.
Representative Nose, you get the last question.
It's more of a comment. I would just observe that at least in Portland public schools, if your son or daughter ends up having a problem with alcohol at school, they are sent to drug and alcohol counseling, where they get to learn about addiction and all that sort of thing. So if you get in trouble, you do get exposed to that.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3352 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3301. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3301 requires insurers to provide a naturopathic physician the choice of being credentialed as a primary care provider or as a specialty care provider.
Would you call the first panel, please?
Dr. Jeff Clark and Dr. Sarah Gilham.
Is that it? Either order, please introduce yourself and you start.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlake, committee. My name is Dr. Jeff Clark. I'm a naturopathic physician in primary care in a private practice in Tualatin, Oregon. I want to thank Representative Lively for introducing this bill on behalf of the patients who seek their primary care from naturopathic physicians. I have a previous career in high tech. I have a computer science degree from Montana State University. Worked in that for a large number of years. And for personal reasons, chose to go back into another career in my mid-40s to learn naturopathic medicine. I chose naturopathic medicine because, as engineering concept is, it had the most degrees of freedom in approaching health and well-being for folks. I went to National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, which is a medical school not unlike all others. We begin learning basic sciences, anatomy, and we go all the way through to clinical sciences like cardiology and rheumatology and so on and so forth. In the realm of therapeutics, we learn the role of nutrients in biochemistry and health. We also learn how to use pharmaceutical drugs to provide interventions when normal health cannot be achieved. Our hands-on practical experience starts with examining the anatomy of cadavers, and it continues on to primary care being provided in the Portland area through community clinics and other venues. The scope of practice of naturopathic medicine is clearly focused on the concept of primary care. We do physical exams, we run laboratory tests, we send people for imaging, we diagnose and then treat disease, we refer to specialists, we send people to hospitalization when their situation is out of control and needs that kind of intensive care. We're very much a general medicine scope of practice. In my written testimony, I've included a link to a presentation that we had given to the Oregon Insurance Division. They very graciously had videotaped that and then made it available to us. So you're welcome to see that if you want to invest that time or while you're doing your knitting or whatever else. I also have a little brochure which has all the main points pretty much bulletized for you so that anybody who wants to go ahead and review what the education and scope of practice of naturopathic physicians as can be sharpened up on that topic. So in January 1 of 2014, the Affordable Care Act had a number of new provisions that came into being in effect. Among them was a section on provider non-discrimination, something I think this committee is well versed in, so I will not go on into great detail on that. But essentially, access to care was one of the things for people to choose to use the provider of their choice as it's licensed in their state, which is what naturopathic doctors are.
That's not exactly a correct interpretation. Oh, but
okay, go ahead.
Well, I think the issue is network adequacy, not whether anybody can use a provider of their choice.
Okay.
It's not any willing provider.
Right, it's not every willing provider. I agree with that. I didn't mean to imply that. So, so since we've had that law come into effect, we've seen a number of positive changes from health insurers that issue policies in Oregon. Generally, general medicine provided by a naturopathic doctor is no longer considered to be an alternative benefit of something, you know, somehow considered to be drastically different. And we've seen that naturopathic doctors are included under that general benefit in most plans that are issued in this state. So that doesn't mean every doctor has credentialed with every plan, but on the plans that we are on, it's no longer policy by policy for the most part. So that's been a really positive thing, and so we're thankful for that and then the changes that have been made. But a very curious thing also occurred on January 1 of 2014 is that several of the major insurers in that issue policies in the state of Oregon unilaterally decided that we were all specialists. And I call it curious because, first of all, I went to medical school at a place teaching me primary care. I didn't go to a specialist program afterwards. Why am I suddenly a specialist? Curiously enough, the Oregon Revised Statutes does not actually allow naturopathic doctors to call themselves specialists. So we've been called something that by an insurance that we're not allowed to call ourselves. So you have to kind of look down a little bit deeper, and the real point that I'm going to propose to you that designation came up was it actually introduced a new barrier to access to patients who choose naturopathic doctors and want to utilize their insurance. With my testimony, I've included a letter from a patient of mine, which, frankly, I learned a lot from reading it myself, but pretty much gives a pretty good idea how that works out to be a barrier. So when a person's a specialist, the patient has to pay a higher copay to see that doctor. And in general, with a few exceptions, specialists are prohibited from covering preventive cares like vaccinations, wellness, and preventative health screenings. The things that are actually guaranteed in the essential health benefits, also part of the Affordable Care Act. And then, as in Mr. Jackwith's written statement, suddenly patients who want to come see me for primary care have to go to a primary care doctor in order to get a referral to see me, a naturopathic doctor who is in network with that particular insurance company. So it's a bit of a dog chasing cat sort of situation here that didn't, anyway, so we're here. House Bill 3301 cures this illness by making the PCP designation being the doctor's choice. Had insurance not thrown these barriers out here by using this designation as a way to make a barrier to patients, we wouldn't be here, but they have, and that is why we're here. So again, thank you, Representative Lively, for introducing this bill with the intent of removing barriers to patient access to the care that they seek from the provider that they choose. Our view of this is that it does not require health insurers to develop a new credentialing process. It simply requires them to let us in to the credentialing process they've already got in place for MDs, DOs, and nurse practitioners who are providing primary care. That's all we want. We just want in. It should not have to be any revision of anybody's bureaucracy. It's just a change in designation. There is also the issue of us being called specialists, since it's actually against Oregon Revised Statutes for naturopathic doctors to declare ourselves this, which has come to us actually from the insurers. We'd like to see an amendment to our already proposed bill that would take that away, so that if a naturopathic doctor chooses to allow that designation to stay, does not want to take on the full set of responsibilities of being a primary care physician, that we are at least not in contradiction with our own licensing law. So I would appreciate that a whole bunch. So naturopathic medicine, it belongs on the forefront of healthcare. Our association, the one that I'm a board director for, the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, we have taking the time to step back and realize that in the context of today, there are more responsibilities than simply the learning. There's the issues of coordination and continuation of care. So we have outlined that. It jives very clearly with the credentialing process that the Oregon Health Authority uses, and which we believe is the standard used to credential primary care physicians with other health insurers. So just to bring this to a close here, in 2010, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention in my introduction, I'm also the first naturopathic doctor to be on the Healthcare Workforce Committee, which reports to the Oregon Policy Board, which is part of the efforts of the Oregon Health Authority. So I've been there. I wasn't there when the report was done that talked about removing barriers to primary care. But in 2010, only 38% of the 10,822 Oregon licensed MDDOs designated themselves as primary care. And that number is actually, or primary care providers, that number is shrinking. Of the doctors graduating from OHSU, one-third or less are planning a career in primary care. I would like to contrast that to what happens at the National College of Natural Medicine, which graduates 80 MDs for every 100 MDs that OHSU does. It's about an 80%. Actually, there's quite a few more graduates coming on than you might suspect. Naturopathic doctors, 99% of them are going through this process and choosing this career with the full intention of providing primary care. So that's our deal. I really thank you for considering this bill. We hope you can agree that labeling NDs as specialists without any recourse, because the insurance that have done this have not allowed us to have a credentialing pathway, creates an unacceptable and unneeded patient barrier to primary care in a state that has a chronic and growing shortage of willing and able primary care providers. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Next, feel him.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, representatives. My name's Sarah Gillum, for the record, and I'm a naturopathic physician. I work for Zoom Care, and I'm here representing both myself as a naturopath and Zoom Care. This is something that's actually really affected our patient base. Naturopaths at Zoom Care are becoming more and more common. We're part of the standard team. We're a one-provider team, MDs, DOs, NPs, PAs, naturopaths. We all practice the same medicine. We treat the same conditions. We diagnose the same. We're held to the exact same standards. But our naturopaths are treated differently by the insurance plans. And this really has a substantial effect on our patients. Approximately 25 to 28% of patients, depending on the month and how many come in from each company, have insurers who specifically force naturopaths into the specialist role. And so for those patients, they're essentially playing Russian roulette when they schedule with Zoom Care. If they happen to have an NP or a PA in the clinic in their neighborhood on that day, they get to pay their regular PCP rates. Whereas if there happens to be a naturopath in that clinic that day, they will have to either have preventive services that are subject to the deductible or pay a higher copay coinsurance. So this has really been a problem for a large proportion of our patients. And we are hiring more and more naturopaths. So we expect by the end of quarter two that there will be hundreds, if not thousands, of patients affected by this just within our company. So it really is a substantial problem, and I think that this bill is a great solution to it that's really just affecting naturopaths, our symbol categorization. And I think, as was mentioned before, most of the companies are able to categorize us as PCPs, and Zoom Care as an integrated healthcare platform that is also an insurer, we're able to do it. So it's something that's definitely possible and will have a positive effect on patient access.
Thank you. Any questions at this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Yes. So what percentage of Zoom Care's physicians are naturopaths?
Yeah, right now we have four naturopathic providers. We have another eight in credentialing. We expect that we'll have between probably 15 and 20 by the end of this quarter, or quarter two, so coming.
And your total number of providers?
And our total number of providers, I believe right now, is right around 50.
Mr. Lively, do you have a comment?
I have several comments. Shall I?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So first, anybody that knows, since I have been here, one of my big issues is continuing to be access, and also not just access, but people being allowed to practice medicine at the height of their license and credentials. And so to me, this was just another step. And after the first session, I worked quite a bit with my CCO trying to get naturopaths as part of, since we have huge shortages in Lane County, as part of the panels and that, so that they could help treat the patients. And we've made some progress there. But over the time, obviously, things have changed, because I can tell you several years ago, my insurance paid for my naturopath naturopathic physician, and then they quit paying for it. But for years, they did pay for mine. And I'm a person that has used naturopathic medicine for a long time that has helped me different than what my regular MD does. And so for me, it was just another one. We ought to have the conversation if we're talking about, you know, the availability of treatment. And who should provide that treatment. It was logical to me that this ought to be another one of those conversations. As you know, I have other legislation trying to adjust the physician shortage. But having a person whose family has a naturopathic physician that we use, it just, to me, it makes great sense that this ought to be another part of our treatment system, and people ought to have access, and especially take away barriers to those that want to make that choice. So that's why I agreed to sponsor this legislation.
Great. Other comments? Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Holt?
Yeah, I think they are. Good choice.
Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. I think from our perspective, this bill needs a little bit more work. The question in our mind is not whether naturopaths have a role. Of course they do, and we've included them in our networks for some time. One of our senior leaders also serves on the board of the Naturopathic College in Portland, so we're very supportive of the practice. The bill, however, the way it's written now, would have the naturopath essentially tell us how they're going to be credentialed, and that's an issue for us. We're happy to and do make the credentialing process available to naturopaths, and like any other provider, we want to have a complete look at their training and background and their practice and so on, and then come to a decision about where they fit, whether it's specialist or primary care. And that's, you know, if there's disagreement there, that usually results in a conversation. I think some rephrasing of that first part is in order. We'd like very much the clarification in the other part of the bill that primary care is clearly part of their scope, because that's largely what they seem to do.
You don't have a problem with allowing them to ask for credentials as primary care physician?
Mr. Chair, no problem at all in them seeking that. Just the way the bill is written, they would be telling us that, and we would not have any other option besides what designation the practitioner chooses.
Do you work with Representative Lively to get this in the form that?
We'd be happy to, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Kenemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you currently have naturopaths as primary physicians?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, I believe we do. I will double-check on that.
Okay. If you could get back to the committee, it would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Representative Bueller?
Curious, how would you determine that designation if a naturopath is going to be primary care or specialty care?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, it'll be an evaluation of the information that's provided to us. I'd be happy to get you more details, but I'm not the expert on credentialing, so I hesitate to go further.
So would you have set criteria, or you just accept what's submitted to you?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I think generally speaking, there are criteria for various practitioners to meet for whatever they're seeking to be credentialed as.
At least it used to be.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3301 and open a work session on House Bill 2880. Madam Minister, what have we got here?
H.R. 2880 had a public hearing on the 9th of March. It specifies that a physician assistant or a PA may not practice fluoroscopy on a person unless the PA holds a certificate that has been issued by the Board of Medical Imaging, requires that the PA to complete 80 hours of didactic and clinical training and pass the examination, directs the Board of Medical Imaging to issue the certificate, has an operative date of August 1, 2016. However, We have a dash one amendment that changes the operative date to January 1, 2016. It also modifies the supervising physician requirement not to be right immediately there with the PA, but in the building. Dash two amendment modifies the definition of fluoroscopy to align with the federal definition.
Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move to adopt the dash one amendments dated February 13, 2015.
Representative Nose moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated 2/13/15 to House Bill 2880. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection? Dash one's in.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to adopt the dash two amendment dated March 6, 2015.
Representative Nose moves the dash two amendment dated 3/6/15 be added to House Bill 2880. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The two is now apart.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion on the bill. I move House Bill 2880 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2880 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Langley?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlake?
Aye. Motion carries. Do I have a volunteer? Whose bill is this?
The committee's.
Okay. Do I have a volunteer to carry it?
I'll do it.
Representative Nose will carry. Close the work session on House Bill 2880 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2551. And I'll step down and start the discussion.
You can drive.
Okay.
Whoever it is, be nice to me. Yeah,
of course.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and thank you for offering me the opportunity to testify on this bill.
You're certainly welcome.
any time if we may.
This bill comes from two places. It comes from my frustration with the situation going on in the healthcare field today, and it comes from my experience as a corporate officer in a healthcare corporation where I spent many years of my life as the vice president of Kaiser Foundation Hospital. One of the things that I learned sometimes as a sadder but wiser administrator was that when the CEO asks for something, things happen. And what's been happening in our country is that private digital information is not being safeguarded properly by healthcare systems. I passed out to you an amazing list of healthcare breaches in digital personal information. Probably something like 20. This is a multi-page document that is in OLIS. I think it's in OLIS. Is that
we're,
right?
We're checking right now. I believe so.
It's supposed to be in OLIS.
It is.
It's a multi-page document of one breach after another of confidential digital information. The estimate we have is about 26 million individual records have been breached in maybe 150 different companies on this list. I've tried this bill in past sessions, and I've had objections from the hospital industry and from the health insurance industry. And I've listened very carefully to those objections, and have narrowed down, and we'll continue. We have one more amendment coming, but I've narrowed this bill down to its absolute absolute essentials. And all it does is require that the CEO of a healthcare organization, being a delivery system or a health insurance program, needs once a year to sign a form. And the form says that person has essentially reviewed the system for maintaining confidentiality of personally identified digital information and has reported any breach or any shortcoming in the system privately to their own board of directors. Now, I've taken out civil penalties. I've taken out anything. Well, one more amendment will take out anything that smacks at having to make that information public. The information is private. It goes only to the auditors, privately to the auditors of that corporation and to the board of directors. I think with the next amendment, and you'll hear at least from somebody, I think with the next amendment, I've taken out anything that anybody could object to. We've taken out civil penalties. We've taken out oversight of reporting of that simple document. And we've taken out almost anything else I can think of that's caused any objection to this. Simple now. Once a year, a CEO signs a form. That means that CCO in practice will call up their information supervisor and say, review with me, I'm going to sign this form, what our system is, and make sure that I can say confidently I feel okay about it. And that's what I'm hoping to simulate. That conversation is what I'm hoping to simulate with this bill.
Any questions from the committee?
I could be different than other witnesses say. I don't want to answer any questions.
Well, you could try that, but I would
see
really,
how that
I'm
works.
Really out of
I would,
order,
I would
Mr.
Be
Chair.
To answer any questions.
Okay,
the
Representative Hayden has a question.
Vice Chair Nose. How would the process, the CCOs are required to do annual audits on a lot of these procedures. How does this integrate with that audit that they have to disclose information like that?
Well, my sense of how it would work in the organization that I've been involved with is somebody reminds me in a month from now I'm going to have to fill out this form that I filled out last year. We pulled it out, and I'm going to say, I better check in with my chief information officer and find out, is it going to be okay to sign the form? They'll have that conversation. When the CIO gets the CEO's request, something happens. Uh-oh, the boss is asking me, how's the system look? I better make sure, from my perspective, that when I go up to the boss's office and say to her, this system is okay, it's safe, or it's a state of the art. Boss, we got to tell you, if China attacks us, we're going to get breached. But short of that, we think the system works. I mean, and it is true. You can't have a problem with the Anthem thing. When China or India as a country attacks a system, they're going to get into that system. But that's not the big problem. The big problem is when a healthcare system, the home care agency of a healthcare system's data security is that they'll put all the patient data on a computer and take it home in their car each night. That's the kind of system we have to avoid. And that's exactly what one of the breaches we've had over the past years is put all the personal data on a computer, put in your car, take it home, and of course the car is broken into and the data's gone. I mean, it's that kind of stuff we're actually looking at.
Other questions? Representative Kenemer.
Maybe this is more comment. We have our post-committee party. I would like to currently nominate the chair for the persistence award.
Well, my OHSU PSU bill is probably the one that would get the most persistence. That's been seven sessions now.
Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll proceed to the next witnesses. Okay, I'd like to call up David Fidenke, Andy Easton, and Tom Holt.
Good job.
And
Sounds exciting.
You want me to keep the gavel? All right. Am I going to get to use it?
Well, you might.
Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Acting Chair, Vice Chair Nose, and Chair Greenlich, and members of the committee. I'm David Tedanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, and pleased to appear today in support of House Bill 2551. I've submitted written testimony for the record, as well as a copy of a story from the Washington Post dated just 3 days ago on the most recent data breaches, data hacks, of both Anthem and Premera, Blue Cross Blue Shield programs in many states, although not Oregon. And on a personal note, I am a Regent subscriber here in Oregon, and just received a notice from Anthem last week regarding their data breach because I had to make an unscheduled stop in Denver last May to visit the emergency room, and that is in their territory. In that hack, which began in May of last year but was not discovered until January of this year, and Mr. Chair, I disagree slightly with you. I think these increasing number of hacks of major healthcare systems is a huge problem going forward. The notices from Anthem indicate that although they did not get access to my medical care portion of my record, they may well have gotten my date of birth, my home address, my Social Security number, and my email address, all the things that an identity fraudster really needs to steal your identity. And in the Premera hack, they apparently did get access to medical information as well. With the move towards electronic healthcare records, and all of this information being accessed on a daily basis between massive data systems, the Washington Post and the experts they consulted said this is probably just the tip of the iceberg, that we're going to see a lot more of this until the healthcare industry gets serious about securing their computer systems and their data. So I would say this bill is well overdue, particularly given the news of the last couple of months, and I hope the committee will pass it out as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? All right. Welcome, Ms. Easton.
Good afternoon. Vice Chair Nose and Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, the Associate Vice President of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And in many years past, I have come up here opposing this bill, but I am pleased that the chair has been persistent with the coming forth with us on this bill and bringing it back. I think we're at a place where we are at somewhat of agreement on the Dash 2 amendments. There are some further language that we would like to see. It has to deal with relieving the exposure to CEOs, and it would be an additional language that would say that data from the report shall not be admissible as evidence in any judiciary, administrative, arbitration, or mediation proceeding. With that extra reassurance taken away with the Dash 2 amendments, the liability pieces that you've worked on, Chair, I think we would be at a neutral, and we're happy to work with you on getting that into either the Dash 3 amendments or work on the Senate side to get them included.
Any questions? All right, Mr. Representative Weyer, do you have a question?
Yeah, real quick. Yeah, because this bill has come up every session that I've been here and everything, and I notice there aren't any penalties. And the thing I always wondered is maybe we should include the state in this as well, so the Secretary of State, Governor, everybody else is held responsible too. You don't need to comment on that.
Okay. Mr. Holt, you ready?
Yes. Vice Chair Noss, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, again, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Chair Greenlick, we appreciate your persistence, there's been now a many years long conversation about this issue, I think. But seriously, this is an important issue. As Mr. Fidanke outlined, I think all healthcare organizations today have become extremely attractive targets for well-organized hackers, not just some kid sitting in a basement, but state-supported hackers and others of that ilk. And so we're very supportive of the intent of the bill to ensure that in all of our organizations this gets the most senior level attention. Certainly in our organization it does. We have a very robust enterprise risk assessment process, and that reports directly up to our CEO. It's something we pay a lot of attention to. There are some further tweaks to the bill and the parts dealing with insurers that we've discussed with Chair Greenlick, really along the lines of making sure that we don't help the hackers at all by laying breadcrumbs for them to follow in the nature of the report that we file, and keeping that information extremely confidential within our organizations. I can just tell you that within our organization, it's extremely sensitive. Some of you have encountered some of that sensitivity when I've sent you emails with the right or wrong number of digits in it. It stops the email. There are other measures that we take, and it's very much kept close to the vest in terms of need to know, so that we don't unintentionally disclose ways that would help people get to people's health information that they aren't supposed to have. So we look forward to working on the next round of amendment and being able to at last have this be the last discussion before this body of this bill. I said this bill. Well, there may be subsequent ones. Yes.
Okay. Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Noss. What kind of corporate liability is there for these types of breaches?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, there is potential for us to be fined very heavily by the federal government as well as by DCBS in the case of Oregon for any negligence on our part that would lead to a data disclosure that's untoward.
A follow-up question, please.
Follow-up.
And are CEOs aware of these potential fines for breaching of confidential data?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Noss and Representative Bueller, they're highly aware of the fine potential.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I'd like to ask a question.
Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued with what Mr. Fidanke said, and the real issue has to do with the extent these data become encrypted. I think that's one of the issues. I just wonder how far. It's not related to this bill. It's just curiosity. How far moving towards fully encrypted data sets we are? I suppose you're not the right person to ask it.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, I don't know the answer to that question. I know there's very recently been a lot of discussion about that, and all I can do is summarize for you what I've sort of gleaned from the trade articles on this subject, and that there is a my understanding is there's sort of a technical balance between how far do you encrypt, which slows down the ability to share data in real time with providers, versus not encrypted at all, and then you're accepting a balance of not having that extra layer. But I would be happy to inquire about where that is with people who actually know something about that.
As we go forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? All right.
Actually, Mr. Chair, or Chair Noss, I think this might be a good bill to actually have IT people come in and discuss these issues with us, so we have a better understanding of what the hospitals are having to deal with and insurance companies. in this information, because it would be worthwhile for us to know this information from IT people. Nothing against lobbyists, but IT people would understand it better.
All right. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. This bill will come back next week. We'll look at the Hospital Association amendments. I think we already have the insurance amendments in process.
Specialties.
We'll probably reschedule it a week from Wednesday, it looks like.
I guess so.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2551. Point out which bill we are, 27. Yeah, I was just looking here. House Bill 2758, as I announced before we started, are we carrying that over or rescheduling?
Rescheduling.
We're going to reschedule that bill also for early next week. Is that all our business today?
Yes, sir.
Wow, look at that.
An hour.
That's because I...
He'll make it up for you.
Was so short.
It's because we had a new chair.
Luxury.
Yeah.
A more efficient chair. That's exactly what it is.
There goes your IT presentation.
We are IT.